Welcome to the New Books Network.
Warren Mansell, welcome back to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. So great to talk to you again. Thanks for being here.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for asking me.
Great. Yeah. Well, of course, we've got this really sprawling and wonderful, rich handbook of perceptual control theory that has really opened my eyes, even as someone who is already, you know, very much on board with the theory and using it in my own work. This isn't just about going even wider in a sense in terms of all the disciplines in which it's having an impact, but going deeper as well. There's tons of new insights and ways that the contributors are not only, you know, quote unquote, applying the foundations of PCT to their work or in their area, but that what their work is doing is deepening the theory itself, which is super exciting. So, of course, we normally begin with a biographical sketch, but since you've been a guest on this before, we'll ask folks to turn to our previous interview, unless there's any biographical update you wish to give us before we jump into the book, because there's so many things we want to talk about, but I'll give you an opportunity if there's anything else you want to say.
No, let's go for it.
Since the last time our listeners met you. Okay. So we're just going to, because it's a big book and it's really an edited volume of chapters, we're going to go through this in a format that Warren and I have agreed upon ahead of time, which is really just sort of chapter by chapter and getting a few thoughts from Warren on the author, what drew Warren as the editor of this volume to invite that person in, and what particular contributions we should be paying attention to. So I guess that we should start with Bill Powers, right? I mean, it's the very first chapter, the founder of the field, so to speak. Anything you want to say about Bill and the beginnings?
Well, of course. I mean, the book was Bill's idea. Sadly, he passed away in 2013. And he talked to his sister, Alice Powers, who ran Benchmark Publications, and had told her that his wish was to get the groups of academics and practitioners that he'd been working with and communicating with over so many years, often decades, and produce an edited book that really showed the world what perceptual control theory could offer. And so he set out a list of the people that he wanted to contribute, and I worked with Alice to liaise with those authors, and also invited some more authors. Some others couldn't make it, so it changed a little bit from Bill's original layout, but the aim of it is the same, to really show what PCT adds to each of these fields. And there's so many different disciplines represented in the field. It was a real honor to work with so many different professions.
That's great. And as I've said, and I think always the most important thing, and I always think of the cybernetician Ross Ashby talking about the ways that those fields then feed back into the original theory as well, and they mutually develop each other, which is beautiful.
Yeah, it's interesting though. We'll probably come back to that, but there's elements of PCT that are kind of fundamental, and there's elements that are about how PCT, given the fundamentals of PCT, how interactions between people, for example, evolve and can be characterized and described in certain ways, how the neural machinery implements it, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's safe to say that the central tenets of PCT, of control, conflict, and reorganization, and the hierarchical organization, are untouched and unmodified by this book. But there's a lot said about how that manifests itself, what implications it has in all kinds of disciplines.
Yeah, you're right. I thank you for that important clarification. I think that's absolutely the case. I guess the kind of thing I was thinking about in particular, and we'll get to it in a bit, I was thinking a lot about Kent McClellan's work, and how his whole, how the, like you say, that the unchanged foundations of PCT alter the way one even views even the built environment. as a network of feedback pathways. So that's the kind of thing I'm thinking about, where there's an entirely novel way of thinking about something that came from as you say, these still untouched and unadapted central concepts of the theory. Great. So first, let's talk about a buddy of ours, Rick Markin, Richard S. Markin, who's also been on this podcast a couple of times, actually. And he's talking in his chapter about understanding purposeful systems, the application of control theory in engineering and psychology.
Yeah.
So tell me what brought you to turn to our friend Rick for this particular contribution.
Well, it was really suitable to start the book with some of the strongest and almost purest advocates of PCT. And that's why it starts with Rick's, Richard Kennaway's and Henry's chapters, who really articulate the importance of PCT itself for science, for methodology. And Rick's chapter was designed to really pull out the importance of what he describes as a reverse engineering perspective that perceptual control theory provides. Its purpose, instead of building machines, is really to try and understand how living things work by trying to understand what they're controlling and using precise tests to establish this. And it's kind of his chapter, and he's written about this in many other times, also reveals how the sort of classic engineering theory, whilst its organization is very analogous to PCT1, there's some critical differences. One being that, or the most critical being, that the comparator in classic theory is put outside the system with the reference point, whereas within PCT, it's acknowledged that the reference point, the goal, is inside the system itself. It sets its own goals. So unlike a thermostat where the user sets the temperature, our bodies set their own temperature in a very mundane example there. And whilst actually, if you talk to any engineer about this in detail, they fully admit that living things have internal goals and yet continue in the convention to show the goal outside the organism. And it's sometimes kind of ignored and thought to be, well, that's just a convention, it doesn't have implications. But actually, the implications are absolutely huge in terms of where that control system, how that control system can be understood in any further detail. For example, in building a hierarchy, it's based upon the idea that that reference point, that goal, is set internally by a level up within the organism itself. So it opens the way within PCT to build a system of far more complexity than you would have in a, you know, in a simple unit. I've probably gone on a bit further than what is in Rick's chapter, but he has been by far the strongest experimentalist within perceptual control theory, and that's another reason why he's got this first chapter leading the way in the handbook.
That's great. Thank you. And that, yeah, that's really important, that distinction that the internal, the goal inside the organization or inside the system, the organism, is what allows the building of the hierarchy itself. That's a really, really important distinction. Thank you for drawing that for us. Let's move to another person who has much to say about that particular flaw in the model of most control theory, and other things he has to say as well. And Henry Yin with his chapter on the crisis in neuroscience.
Yeah, and Henry's writing is impeccable, and it's all the more impressive that he came to perceptual control theory fairly recently compared to most of the other authors. But the depth at which he describes it and the clarity is really impressive, and because he's so well versed in neuroscience research, both its, you know, its strengths and its flaws, in this chapter he's been able to describe some classic examples of research in neuroscience and kind of exposed, if you like, the vulnerabilities of that research, because it's been assumed that the observer's perspective on the stimulus and the response take priority and form the fundamentals of the model. Whereas from PCT, it's all about building the model from the inside of the organism, taking the input, for example, in a classic kind of fly study, trying to understand what the fly perceives going into its sensory cells, its vision, rather than taking the observer's view and coding that as the stimulus. And again, it's one of those unquestioned assumptions that permeates the literature in neuroscience. And it takes someone with Henry's experience and some of his most classic recent experiments to demonstrate that that flaw, really, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to me that while Henry, in some ways, I think it's safe to say, is not a fan of sort of classic cybernetics, there's a link between what he's talking about and second order cybernetics, in that the mistake of relying on the observer's understanding of that and the fact that we need to think about the observer's world, going all the way back to sort of the Umwelt of von Uxhall.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's a key link between them.
Yeah,
I think.
And PCT makes this really smooth link between those leaders within ethology, like Umwelt, and an experimental methodology. And I think sometimes, and it's certainly the case in my field, the kind of phenomenological side of psychology is almost kind of taken away from its quantitative precision, as though the two are separate. Only the observer of an experiment can use precise quantitative methods, whereas the phenomenologist, person describing phenomenology, has to rely on kind of introspective description, and that's just not the case. Mm. You can build a quantitatively precise study from the perspective of the person or the organism that you're studying, and that in a sense is the point of PCT, and it's the elegance of the kind of studies that Rick and Henry have done.
Terrific. Thank you. Yeah. Great. We'll move on to the third person you've mentioned as a kind of the pure PCT sort of advocates and people sort of articulating that, to Richard Kennaway with the chapter, When Causation Does Not Imply Correlation, Robust Violations of the Faithfulness Axiom.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking at Richard's chapter again recently, and, you know, I think if a chapter like his had been published to the physical sciences, it would be met with a kind of a reversal of current theory, because, you know, physicists are used to mathematical arguments and cases being made through the precision of the mathematical demonstrations. But in psychology and neuroscience, one can make a very robust mathematical argument, and then it can be just kind of considered as a perspective on this research area. But actually, Richard puts this very succinctly in the chapter. He says, the very function of a control system is to actively destroy the data that current techniques of causal analysis work from. And that's because a control system is constantly striving to remove the causal effects of disturbances upon the variables that it cherishes, that it's controlling. And so it keeps a variable very close to its desired state, reducing its variation sometimes to zero. And so the chances of getting anything to correlate with that variable, because it's so well controlled, become extremely hard as well. But the whole system is a causal loop that is through its the connections, the causal connections between its elements, because they're arranged in a closed loop that is keeping some variable tightly controlled. You're not gonna find evidence of that causal system by looking at correlations. And so this whole assumption within neuroscience, within psychology, that we're looking for correlations between X and Y, and that's going to give us some insight as to where the causal mechanisms might be, even though it won't fully explain it, is a false assumption. You can find causal systems that defy correlations between elements that we know are connected because we've built a model that replicates it, and at the same time have correlations between elements that aren't connected. The classic example, it's very simple really, is imagine two people, person A and person B. They're both pointing at each other. Person A's goal is to keep their finger always right next to person B's finger. So when person B moves their finger randomly, person A just has to track their finger as tightly as possible. Okay. Now, if this is done really well, then that distance between the two fingers remains at zero. But it's that distance that is being controlled, that is the reference point in person A's head. And yet the correlation is between the two people's movements. But there's no direct connection between the two people. They're one person trying to track the other. That other person doesn't actually influence that person's finger movement. It's only because person A has selected their own goal of trying to track person B that the two finger movements are even related to one another. There's no causal relationship between person A and person B. And so, you know, and we do a lot of demonstrations when we're training PCT to show this case. But it's quite, it always strikes me as, I don't know if trouble's the word, but perplexes me that such demonstrations of the insufficiency of simple sort of linear causal models don't go the full way and help people to realize that we really need to move on in terms of our methodologies and our assumptions about the nature of life.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if it's a kind of a sunk costs kind of thing. It's like there's too much to overturn.
Absolutely.
Now. We've invested too much. We've gone too far. There's no turning back.
And there's absolutely a theory behind that PCT can lend itself to.
Absolutely.
But that is the nature of change. And that's all we'll come to method of levels later. But there's nearly always sunk costs involved in making changes to systems, to goals that people have invested long time in, even if they create conflict, even if they undermine one's overarching goal, you know, for scientific inquiry.
Well, I think many of us can identify, particularly in our undergraduate years, with being that person at a party who gets into an argument and takes one position, and then at a certain point you realize your argument is crumbling, but you're damned if you're going to give it up. Hopefully we've outgrown that by the time we're, actually in academia, but maybe not.
I doubt it.
Yeah. Great. Let's move on to section B now, which is a group of chapters under the heading Models of Brain and Behavior. Mm. And the first is Unraveling the Dynamics of Dyadic Interactions, Perceptual Control in Animal Contests. So this is going back to the connection with ethology. This is by Sergio M. Pellis and Heather C. Bell.
Yeah. So now we're into the domain of what you can do once you know PCT in these different areas, rather than in the first three chapters really demonstrating the validity of PCT. And what Sergio has done with PCT, and more recently with Heather's work, is, you know, it's tremendous. So he actually discovered a form of coding animal behavior through a researcher who had understood cybernetics, applied it to dance moves, and then it became a method of coding for animal contests.
I love that. I love that so much. That's elegant.
It all goes round, doesn't it? It all comes round. And Heather and Sergio in that chapter have shown that across the animal kingdom, you find that the complexities of body movements between two animals in contest, often rivalry or fights, can be explained by much more simple rules than other theories would tend to put forward, namely that certain variables are being controlled by either or both animals. And one of those is to get close, for example, get your teeth close to the nape of the other animal, because that shows you're dominant to it. And all this rolling around and sort of what looks like maybe certain strategies, it's argued, is really the emergent process whereby the animal is trying to keep that distance to the other animal despite what its rival is doing to prevent it. And you can see this in all kinds of contests in animals, and obviously in humans, in not just in dance, obviously, but in sport. There are many examples of this. And I've gone on to do some work on predator-prey relationships, sort of inspired by Sergio's work. I met Sergio and Heather when they came over for one of our international conferences. And, you know, it's just fabulous. What they've been doing. There's another colleague, Louise Barrett, who is a really helpful reviewer for this chapter. And so I think PCT and ethology can really work together very well. And I think the most inspiring element is the fact that some of these, if you like, cybernetic rules apply across widely different species. Mm-hmm. You know, they're real principles of life rather than, which is, again, you know, I look to other areas of science, and Charles Darwin's approach to the complexities of all the different life forms was to say, I know what, I'm going to try and identify some basic principles and algorithms that can explain change over generations in all life, irrespective of what species it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what PCT is. It's an attempt to try and find the underlying principles of all behavior across all species.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's obviously going to be refinements and ramifications of that for different species and different contexts. But those basic principles run through this book and run through the PCT research.
Yeah, and if you go right back to you know, Wiener's seminal book in cybernetics, of course, the subtitle, Communication and Control in the Animal and the Machine. He was not just speaking about humans, and, you know, references to the famous imprinting stuff, Conrad Lorenz, right, and the ducks would maintain that distance, mm-hmm, all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Has the influence of animal behavior has been with us in these studies for a long, long time.
Yeah, and of course, as it interfaces with kind of attachment theory and some of the neuroscience work on fundamental emotions, it becomes really critical.
Wow. Great. So now we move on to Erling O. Jorgensen's multi-chapter piece called How the Brain Gets a Roaring Campfire. And the first part, chapter 6 in the book, is Structuring for Perceptual Results.
Yeah. So Erling actually has a third chapter, which I think is open access. He wrote reams and reams for this book. So part of the job was to keep it in a manageable length. And some of the extended versions are on the kind of supplementary materials. And I wasn't aware of Erling's work before talking to Alice about the book in the first place, but I liaised with him, and he shared with me his ideas, and it just seems so important. And this is a theme that I'm coming back to in my conference talk in September, and I touched upon it in my chapter in this book, which is there is so much hard work and data out there that other researchers have done across neuroscience, across all kinds of disciplines. And yes, it's not been done with the perspective of PCT, and that draws the kind of criticisms that, that Henry and Rick will put to them. But at the same time, we have to remind ourselves, when Bill wrote his key book in 73, he drew upon facts and figures and data of the neuroscience of the time. And he used those as examples, and he used those to show how the theory panned out. And this is what Erling does. He takes two different hugely detailed expositions, one of the layers of the neocortex involved in memory and hierarchical memory, and the other in terms of the visual system and the, again, the hierarchical abstraction of different visual codes. And he reinterprets them within the frames of PCT. Now, this could be thought of as a kind of a magpie-like appropriation of other people's work, but the way that Erling writes it clearly shows that's not the case. He uses the metaphor of a campfire to illustrate all these levels and to have a kind of a vivid theme that brings these theories and quite a lot of neuroanatomical detail to life. And he kind of reminds the reader in every page, really, about how a PCT perspective would consider this data and how it makes it different, what it means. So classically, in that chapter 6, the incredible work that Jeff Hawkins has done on the neuroscience of intelligence, despite all its complexities, it's still framed in this almost monotonous way of that current cognitive science sees the brain as a some kind of prediction machine. And that theme comes through. But there are glimpses within that description that Jeff Hawkins talks about prediction not as prediction, but as desires, desired perceptions, as wanted inputs, rather than as kind of things that will happen, as the classic meaning of prediction. Mm-hmm. I've had lots of conversations with the many researchers in this field that kind of talk about the meaning of words. And I think it's a fair point, the word control has many meanings, and yet PCT takes a specific meaning of it. The word prediction has many meanings, and yet cognitive science and, for example, predictive coding or free energy principle take a specific meaning of it. But in my view, when that meaning actually comes so close to control of input being a simpler and more accurate way of describing it, then that's the way it should be. And that's what Erling does within this chapter. He shows that control of input makes clear sense in describing the functions of these neural systems at various levels. And he also shows the interesting parallels between the way that memory was described within Bill's 73 book and the specific levels of perception that Bill described as having many parallels within what's in that neuroscience literature. But of course, PCT wasn't exhaustive and isn't exhaustive in terms of those different codes of perception. And so I think kind of what you're saying right at the beginning, Erling's chapter gives some ideas about some other avenues regarding the types of perceptions that might be controlled by the brain that are there within the sort of classic cognitive literature, but would be quite beneficial to explore within PCT.
Yeah, and this work, Erling's work, is on my mind as I'm currently reading a book about Greek drama, as I'm getting prepared to direct some of my students in some adaptations of classical tragedy. And it's a book that's part of the still ongoing so-called cognitive turn in theater studies, and it's leaning heavily into Andy Clark. And so it's talking about, you know, the top-down predictive meets the bottom-up perceptive. And I just keep thinking PCT would probably deal with this in a simpler fashion. So yeah, the ways it can clarify and make the kinds of things that Andy Clark and others are saying in an even more sort of parsimonious fashion, I think is really important.
It's hard because cognition and motivation have been divided from one another since time began, essentially, certainly since empirical psychology began. And it's very hard for people to get out of that mindset, to think that they could be entwined and part of the same closed system. But that's PCT. It's basically seeing cognition and motivation not as separate, but as part of the same unit, part of the same understanding of life. And it means that therapeutically and with interventions that we make, we're so aware of the agency of the other person, their needs, their wants, their need to be in control and to feel safe, rather than piling in with some way of trying to modify their beliefs or make cognitive change before we've even really thought about, well, why are they here? What do they want? Being primary and fundamental to living well.
Yeah. Should we jump ahead to Franz's chapter?
Yeah.
Okay. So the phylogeny, ontogeny, causation, and function of regression periods explained by reorganizations of the hierarchy of perceptual control systems. And of course, reorganization continues to be one of the areas where people are that I think most PCT folks working with PCT admit continues to need the most development. And this definitely moves well in that direction.
It's true. I mean,
and it's Franz. Now, I'm of Dutch heritage, but I still can't claim that I know how to pronounce his last name. So I'm going to leave it to you. Franz Ploy. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Franz. I mean, it's so interesting. So many of the people in this book are both really lovely people and have got I'm deeply in awe at their knowledge and their understanding and just the way they've engaged with nature to do their work, like with Sergio and Heather, but with Franz, again, it's the intensive work that he did with free living chimpanzees and their infants, and then the work that he did with human infants, which ended up being a best-selling parenting book, The Wonder Weeks. Mm-hmm. And this chapter is just a catalogue of his work, the experimental work alongside that, and the kind of the big ideas around evolution and phylogeny. It's incredible, but it's a really good reference point that I use when I'm explaining PCT to people to remind them how we developed to control things in the way we do. And it wasn't always this way. And, when we were first born, things were very unstructured and random. And you can see that in young infants. And over time, it appears in stages. A young infant learns to see the world in new ways. And then because it can perceive the world in new ways, bring about change, control aspects of the environment to achieve that perception, which can start as simple as working its way up a temperature gradient to be able to suckle from its mother, and becomes as complex as around forming the kind of attachments and relationships into adulthood, and so it's fantastic the way that Franz engaged with PCT, Again, he found out it through neuroscience. A senior researcher called Lex Cools, again from the Netherlands, explained it to him. And again, like most people with PCT, you don't look back. He's just taken it and shown what potential it can provide in terms of understanding infant development, but also, and we're starting to see this now in the book, building interventions, and his intervention about helping new parents to realize that all children go through difficult times, and often these are around where they are going through a developmental shift. And when you're going through one of those, you're unable to control the world in the way you want to be. Skills are lost. Kids at that age get very, Franz calls it, cranky, distressed. Mm-hmm. They need their parents more. And Wonder Weeks helps explain that to parents and helps them realize that this is a process they're going through. You just need to be there for them. And the wonderful thing is, when they're through it, they get to the new level and they develop all these new skills that they never had before. So it's another really kind of positivistic aspect of PCT, when you can see this kind of trajectory for it through infancy, mm-hmm. and the way it's been used in a very accessible way for parents.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Wonderful. So we move on now to section C, which is the section that, given my own work, not just, you know, with actors and directors in the conventional way, but my own work working in conflict within organizations from a PCT perspective. Mm-hmm. Section C is collective control and communication. So collective control and communication. And we start mm-hmm. with a chapter I referenced already, Kent McClellan's chapter, Social Structure and Control, Perceptual Control Theory and the Science of Sociology.
Yeah, the wonderful thing about these three chapters is that Kent, Bruce, and Martin all worked together, sharing mm-hmm. early scripts with each other. And they were actually developing and refining definitions of terms as they yes. were writing these chapters. It was amazing to see it unfold.
Yeah, it's very powerful. It's yeah. very powerful, the yeah. things they've developed together. It's really a blockbuster section yeah. of the book for yeah. me, yeah.
And Kent was writing a book at the same time. There's a book out there called Stability that's not published that builds on these ideas. Mm. So this chapter really is a condensed version of that. I've met Kent a number of times, and he came to Manchester about 10 years ago now to do some teaching for us. And, you know, that's the other thing, what I'm saying about everyone. Everyone in this field is so generous with their time and at the same time just intellectual heavyweights, but often in a minority sense in their own field, because most other people are doing something very different in their field. And that's clearly the case for Kent, who uses this very kind of mathematically precise theory drawn from engineering to work with sociology. That said, there have been theories within sociology, like identity control theory, that are basically based on PCT. And Kent's done his bit to push that forward. I mean, Kent's contributed a lot to PCT, including the name perceptual control theory. But the concept classically that he's contributed is the notion of collective control. And he's kind of explored the conditions, the limitations, and the consequences of people working to dig together to control their own perceptions. So even though, according to the theory, we're only controlling our own perception of what's out there in the world, in the physical world, we can work together to build things in the world, as we see around us, of course, through just controlling our own perception of it. And he has a kind of a classic example of like three people trying to keep a post still in the ground, and they've all got different perceptions of that post from their own point of view, but they're trying to keep it vertical as they perceive it, using their reference of what vertical is. And even though they're coming from different angles and they're moving, they've got different bodies and what have you, they are constantly working together to keep that post still. And obviously we see this in every sphere of life. People don't necessarily all have a plan of how they're going to do things. They have a plan of what they want. And then when they get to the job, they work together and they compensate for each other and they manage things in the moment to create things out there in the world. And actually these things out there in the world are often things that facilitate our control in themselves. Mm-hmm. Most obviously the computer and mobile phones and what have you, but and clearly things like roads and
transit systems,
et cetera, et cetera. You could obviously list so many, but it's a way of framing those aspects of our environment, not as weirdly some kind of stimulus that triggers our behavior. How would that ever work? But as things that we've created to meet our goals, to allow us to get the experiences we want to experience. So we use these tools, these devices as feedback paths to get to see the things we want to see, to create the art we want to create, to say the words we want to say, to compose the music we want to compose and hear, etc. And so there's an open playing field, really, and Kent's populated it in this chapter.
Yeah, it's really brilliant and is already having a huge influence on the stuff that I'm thinking about, conceiving of the workplace in that way, as a set of ideally enabling feedback paths, but where are those paths blocked or where are they accessible to one person, but creating a blockage or a disturbance for another? And it's a really powerful way. Even just think of entirely a society, as the structure of feedback pathways that are more accessible to some than others is a powerful way of moving. Yeah,
absolutely.
Great. And so, as you mentioned, the subsequent chapters that were written in cooperation together. So we've got Martin Taylor next with Perceptual Control in Cooperative Interaction, who, again, as you say, picks up some of the language and the definition of terms that is first laid out in Kent's chapter.
And again, Martin, a huge intellectual heavyweight.
I mean, it's
unbelievable what he's written in the level, and he just illustrates everything with a new diagram. He must have done thousands. Again, Martin's written a book that is, the wider extensionist chapter that is marvelously detailed, and it describes things like, the nature of money and how that evolved. It's incredible. And Martin's got this background within human machine interface in defense systems. He's interested in how people work not just together to control the same thing, but they work in sort of kind of lines of control in kind of subordinate and kind of in the kind of relationships where people do what other people ask them to do, or they help one another, or they take on information from what other people have said and engage in what he defines as protocols, kind of systems of interaction that have a known, structure to them, like a handshake, like the protocol when you engage as a student in a lecture, etc. And again, it's an example of where you take the principles of the theory and you just observe what they look like in a complex social context where people are they're controlling their own perception, but they're doing that through the use of someone else who's controlling some other experience. It's something as simple as saying, can you pass the salt? I'm using the perceptual apparatus of another person to find the salt and give it to me, so they become part of my feedback path to get what I need. And obviously once you get 2, 3, 4 people in the interaction, the potential for those routes becomes very complex, that probably puts off most authors, but but Martin just pans them out and illustrates the implications.
Yeah, it's again, it's incredibly powerful, and the, as I say, just all these three of these chapters have got me thinking about the nature of work in a new way that opens.
And we
up.
Come to work again later, don't we, with Jeff Vancouver's? Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Of course, yeah. So to finish off this sort of this trilogy of papers, we've got Bruce Nevin's Language and Thought as Control of Perception.
Again, it's just incredible the range that Bruce covers, from the very physical kind of way that a phoneme is pronounced, right through to the kind of high level meaning that we need in order to understand the purpose of any linguistic statement, for that communication to have any meaning to us. And again, peppered with diagrams to illustrate how, in the spirit of PCT, you know, we explain things by showing how they work. We don't just use our words. And also, I could never do justice to this in this interview, but there's some fabulous ways that Bruce has illustrated the different facets of language. He's even got a section there on the development of language, and that helps to understand the hierarchical nature of language, that actually you can parse it out into a hierarchy that, again, has very close parallels to the hierarchy of PCT for obvious reasons. I think that understanding language is a real challenge for PCT, because PCT lends itself most easily to kind of continuous control, to kind of skill and kind of motor experiences, whereas language has this kind of logical, organized and propositional structure to it, you know, symbolic structure to it. Now, Bill was well aware of this, and he talked about the use of language, and he had conversations with Phil Runkle about it. But as far as I know, Bruce is the first to really write extensively about how to understand language within PCT.
Yeah, and it's a huge contribution, because I think that it that could be one place where those who still want to resist PCT would ask the question, well, what about language?
Yeah.
And Bruce is really clarifying and again demonstrating the power of the theory. This is one of those examples where it's like, you know, both cyberneticians, those who call themselves cyberneticians, and those who call themselves perceptual control theorists, can get accused of being kind of wild-eyed evangelists, you know, because they've got a theory of everything. But, you know, when you look at this book, I mean, the explanatory power across all of these domains, I mean, it really is convincing, I think. So,
yeah, I think that's part of, you know, what convinced me about PCT. And I developed the site pctweb.org to illustrate that if a theory is correct about behavior, the nature of behavior, it's going to be validated across every discipline of the social and life sciences. It's not just going to be true within one subset of psychology, even if within that one subset of psychology, the largest study with the biggest sample size and the most robust experiment is done. I think there's more to be said for finding convergence of the same principles coming up again and again and again from multiple perspectives, you know, and that's, as I say, that's illustrated in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we get into section D, applications. And of course, yeah, thank you for reminding me that this chapter that goes directly into the nature of work, Jeffrey B. Vancouver's chapter, Perceptions of Control Theory in Industrial Organizational Psychology, Disturbances and Counter-Disturbances.
So Jeff Vancouver was an author that I really wanted to contribute to this book. His work is within the industrial psychology and organizational psychology domain, but actually if you look at his research, it really speaks to social psychology and personality psychology. It's actually got very wide implications. And some of Jeff's papers have been actually some of the most well-cited papers that have used perceptual control theory. He wrote a chapter, a review in 1996 covering the concepts of goals in psychology. And it was a kind of a huge overview of goal constructs. But if you read that review, it's underpinned by PCT. Mm. And he has been one person who's really pushed forward the need for computational modeling as opposed to some of the group statistics that I mentioned earlier within psychology as being almost a necessary stage in validating a theory. And he's done it within a field, social psychology, that it's quite hard to build those computational models compared to, say, motor control, robotic models, for example. And again, it's deeply impressive the kind of detail within which he's done computational modeling using PCT. This chapter has got a more personal touch to it. It's basically explaining his kind of battle, if you like, with the more traditional, largely cognitive and behavioral social psychologists, and wrangling over some precious constructs like self-efficacy theory, for example, or even the nature of goals. And he's still kind of fighting that fight and attempting to explain the nature of a goal as a control of input and the necessity, just like what I said earlier with Rick Kenaway's work, of having to do computational models to do proper scientific testing of living systems. And so, again, it was a real privilege to have Jeff's chapter in here.
Mm-hmm. And then we move to the method of levels, which, of course, is your domain of application. And you've written this chapter with David M. Goldstein. We've only got a few minutes left, and we won't be able to get into MOL as in-depth as we'd like, but I turned people to my previous interview with Warren about a book that came out with Routledge entirely about doing the method of levels. But what do you want to say about what your goals were for this particular chapter in the context of this handbook?
Yeah, so originally both David Goldstein and Tim Carey were going to write separate chapters in the book. But Tim didn't write his chapter, so I helped David put his chapter together. And David's in there because Bill has had a long-standing kind of working relationship with David, and they wrote quite a bit on this PCT way of understanding psychology. There's a book called The Introduction to Modern Control Theory that David Goldstein and a number of others worked on to really brings PCT into the psychology mainstream. And David Goldstein was aware of Bill's method of levels many decades ago. So he was around when Bill was first sharing his method with others. The purpose of this chapter is just to explain that what method of levels is, how it was developed, and what the current evidence is for it. And in doing so, we basically describe how Tim Carey worked with Bill Powers in the 1990s to create method of levels into an actual therapy or a counselling method. And it brings us up to date in terms of where method levels is now.
Mm-hmm. Great. And again, I turned people to my previous interview with Warren on the method of levels.
That's a good idea.
Well, we're running short on time. Unfortunately, we won't be able to talk in depth about each author, but I do want to mention Rupert Young's great chapter about robotics in the real world, perceptual control theory approach, and Rupert's PCT approach to robotics, very, very different from other sort of mainstream approaches to robotics.
It's incredible.
Extraordinary.
And he's led the way. And now people like Henry Yin are following suit and building robots to test and demonstrate PCT. And Rupert, again, just takes no prisoners. He just just knows PCT and he just builds robots according to that, to PCT. He's got his own company and he's built dozens of robots that you can see on YouTube that are based on the principles. And in this chapter, he's really provided that data in a depth that you maybe don't see in some of his other work.
Yeah. I hope Rupert continues or is able to get the kind of support his work deserves, because he's continued to sort of swim against the mainstream in robotics in a way that is really remarkable and deserves support.
Yeah.
And then Roger K. Moore's PCT and Beyond Toward a Computational Framework for Intelligent Communicative Systems.
Yeah. And Roger's taught PCT in Sheffield for, I think it's well over a decade now. He's, you know, he clearly sees the advantages of PCT. He's come into it in a very different way to Rupert, at quite a high level in terms of how we would build artificial systems to understand language, but to truly understand language, not just to process language in a kind of big data way that we see through machine learning, but instead through modeling the intentions of the conversation partner. And so he's kind of built this hypothetical system of language recognition that would use that process that he's never built in real life yet, but he has kind of demonstrated sort of robotic examples. So it's a vision, but I think it's a vision that is realistic in the next 10, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. So I love the way that Rupert's work and Rogers and of course others too is pointing the way to which PCT can create new opportunities and a whole new conception of what artificial intelligence might be.
Yeah.
And again, harkens back to efforts back in earlier days of cybernetics as well, with Heinz von Förster's Biological Computer Laboratory, that was much more interested in the analog than the digital. So yeah, there's these alternate methods of artificial intelligence undergirded by PCT are in the works.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing, the first chapter of Bill's 1973 book is just basically analog computing. It's telling you the building blocks that he sees of the brain that neurons can differentiate, they can integrate, they can sum, they can subtract. These are parallel, these are analogous within analog computing.
Absolutely.
You just too new.
Yes. An idea whose time has come again, it seems, hopefully.
Well, maybe now, maybe in another 100 years.
Yeah, maybe so. Well, this has been great. Thank you for doing the exhaustive work of taking us on a guided tour through this very
little promotion for my final chapter.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Our question is always, what's next?
Yeah, well, I mean,
I know the answer to that. Was there something else you wanted to mention too?
Well, the final chapter is kind of trying to lay the record straight about PCT in terms of how it's been used in other theories, how it's influenced them, or how it's been used across different domains, and how it's different from other theories. And it also addresses some of the criticisms about PCT that are often pitched at kind of feedback control systems in and of themselves. But it also, towards the last few pages, kind of puts out there where there's research and there's areas that haven't even been touched upon by these amazing kind of dozen or so chapters of this book. Part of that is work that I'm going forward with, and part of it is work that's going to come into volume 2. So, you know, Elsevier have kindly put the finances behind a second interdisciplinary handbook with a whole new set of authors. And this time I've selected them from people that have maybe been using PCT in more recent years, many of them, but have used it in much more divergent areas, in education, in philosophy, your own work in theatre. in design, building design. It's stunningly diverse. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a second volume to show that how diverse the applications can be of PCT.
Well, I'll tell you, it's a great, great honor to be involved in that project, and super excited to be working with you and the other great authors on it to bring that to fruition and continue to carry forward this work and continue to get it known amongst the public. But a huge thank you to you, Warren, for being such a great standard bearer for PCT, for the Method of Levels, and for the whole community. And a huge thanks for being here with us again to take us through this book and set the stage for the follow-up volume coming soon.
No problem. Thanks, Tom.
All right. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon. You've been listening to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network, where I've been talking to Warren Mansell about the Interdisciplinary Handbook of Perceptual Control Theory. Thanks very much.